All right. Well, we're going to continue in our study in 40 points, a 40-point overview of the Bible. Okay, so we're on point number 14 today, which happens to also be about the 14 judges that are listed for us in the Scriptures. Okay, so we're going to begin today looking into that. Let me just show you our past points. First 6 points, the beginnings of, creation, the beginnings of sin, beginnings of nations, beginnings of languages, and also slipped in there God's judgment with the flood because of the way sin was growing and kind of exponentially. Then we have Roman numeral 2, beginnings of Israel, the founding fathers of Israel, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. Then we have the Israelite nation incubated in Egypt for 430 years, coming out of Egypt 2 million strong with the spoils of Egypt along with them, heading off to the promised land, exciting time under the leadership of Moses, and then eventually Joshua. We got into Joshua last week, and so we're going to transition from Joshua into the book of Judges. Of course, Joshua tells us in Joshua chapter 24, verse 15, Joshua at the end of his life makes an appeal to the nation of Israel. He says to them, and if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve. Right? And then he talks about the gods of the Amorites in the land that you're going to here dwelling in, or the gods of the Egyptians that we came out of Egypt. Make your choice. If it seems like a bad idea to serve God, make your choice. Don't waffle. Don't fence sit. Book of James tells us that a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Hey, live for God or don't. Choose you this day whom you will serve. Now, I kind of think, when I look at that, and this is borne out by what the commentary we have here at the start of the book of Judges as to the spiritual condition of the nation. He wasn't saying that to a group of people that were not serving other gods and were not making poor decisions. And sometimes they'd serve Jehovah and sometimes not. He was saying this to a group of people that he knew had problems. They were not faithful to God. And so he was leaving life at the end of his leadership and the end of his life with Israel with this, really this appeal, serve God. But make your choice. And then he says, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So he had made his clear choice. Well, that's a choice all of us have. But we're going to see in the book of Judges, we'll talk about it today, the cycle of disobedience that the nation of Israel has. But what was true for them can be true for us. Now, the cycle of disobedience there is about the nation of Israel. And in that sense, it might differ because we're not necessarily, like a Christian nation that is, especially, we're definitely not a theocracy that Israel was. By theocracy, a nation ruled by God. God was their king. And so later when they reject Samuel, God says to Samuel, who is the last judge, by the way, says to Samuel, well, I guess maybe some of his sons helped in judging. But anyways, right there at the end of the period of the judges, God says to Samuel, they didn't reject you, they rejected me. They don't want me for their king. They want to replace me with a human king. And so that'll come later. But during the time of the judges, we have these judges who are leading Israel, and we don't have a king at that point, but that was a theocracy. Really, God raises up human leaders to help him in the administration of the laws that were given and so forth. Well, we're going to actually go ahead and take a look, going to our next slide, at that cycle of disobedience that is here. And we learn about this, and I'm going to use an example here out of Judges chapter 2. Remember that we are doing an overview, so we're not covering everything out of the book of Judges. Finally cried uncle and gave in to turning this into a 2 Sunday school lesson on this point. I was having trouble well, I could do the book of Judges in one Sunday. It's not that hard to do. I could do the book of Judges in 2 minutes. It's just that I don't really teach all that I would kind of like to teach in it. So I was trying to see if I could get it all into one, but I just realized it's not going to happen. I mean, you've been around me long enough to know Mr. Mattish doesn't go really short messages. So I was like, I know me. It's not going to happen. I got too many things in here that would be good to say. 2 Sundays. Well, we'll get going today, but we're going to see now this cycle that's in here as we don't go through everything. But let's hit Judges chapter 2 and see early on where God identifies what this cycle looks like. Now, I'm using a 4S point. See how they all start with S's? And speaking of praying for Pastor Dean this morning, that's actually, if I cited my source, that's where I'd cite it from. Now, I don't know what his source was. But this is what I learned from him when I was a little kid, when he was teaching junior church. And he did a really good job of, you know, repeating it. Repetition's a key to learning. And such that, yeah, I've never forgotten these. And the 4 S's make it, make it kind of stick in the head if you kind of get them down. Sin, servitude, supplication, salvation. So we're going to look at those, and I'm going to show those here in the book of Judges in a little bit when we get to verse 11. But first we're going to start with verse 1 and get a feel for this time period. It says, "And an angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim." Now this angel of the Lord, I think most likely is a theophany, a theo prefix meaning God. Which is where a theocracy is, one form of government, theo, God. So we don't have a monarchy, democracy, republic, you know, communist country, other oligarchies and other, you know, forms out there. Some people in our country would like us to go into mass chaos where there is no government at all. That'd be another type of government, no government. But here we have a theocracy. But I believe most likely this is a theophany. A pre-incarnate appearance of God. Okay, I don't even have to say it that way, I guess. We usually say that if we think it's Christ in particular, a Christophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. Who's this angel of the Lord? By the way, the word angel means a messenger. So the word angel in the Bible, of course, we automatically as Americans, when we think of angels, we get very specific with it. An angel's an angel. Okay, and I don't know how I could even define that because everyone's thinking the same thing I am. At least I'm going to assume that. You're thinking of an angel when you think of an angel. Of course we know what an angel is. It's like when you think of a dog, you think of a dog. Okay. Now if I'm calling someone a dog as a nasty kind of insult, you dog, well then in that context, we're thinking of someone who's not a great person. So you call them a dog. Okay, an angel's an angel, right? Well, no, in the Bible, the word angel is a messenger. An angel could be used for a prophet, could be used for a pastor, like in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, when they're writing to the angel at each church. I think the best thought on that is the writing to the pastor at each church. That pastor in the church is the messenger of that church and giving God's message. So here, though, an angel of the Lord, it seems likely that this is God. And this angel identifies so closely with God, as you'll hear in kind of the word. It just seems like this is God talking here. And so some commentators that I've looked at agree. Well, let's read verse 2. What does this angel of the Lord say? Actually, back up in verse 1. "I made you to go up out of Egypt and have brought you unto the land which I swear unto your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you." Now, does this sound like God talking here? Now, you might say, well, no, it's the messenger giving God's message. Well, yeah. But like I said, I think the majority opinion is that this is God himself providing this message. Judges 2:2. "And you shall make," and I said, "you shall make no league with the inhabitants of the land. You shall throw down their altars. But ye have not obeyed my voice. Why have ye done this? Wherefore I also said, I will not drive them out from before you, but they shall be as thorns in your side, and their gods shall be a snare unto you. And it came to pass when the angel of the Lord spake these words unto all the children of Israel, that the people lifted up their voice and wept. Of course, when you see these, like the nation of Israel being addressed here, I doubt this, the whole nation came to one spot. The angel coming and at least addressing a lot of the leadership who's going to then relay this message to Israel. And maybe there's a crowd there gathered. But God delivers a message. Now in chapter 1, you see God bringing up the problems that existed during this time. And during the life of Joshua, they did not always obey the Lord fully, and they did not drive out all the inhabitants. Sometimes I think they got comfortable. They didn't do what God wanted them to do. It's like we can start settling down into our farm. Yeah, there's a group of them over the hill, but they just made a choice and didn't fully obey God. And so God says, you didn't fully obey me. Well, there's consequences for this. Now, this goes back to the covenant relationship that God had. Here in verse 1, he's an angel of the Lord. Back in, I believe it was Exodus, he's identified as angel of the covenant. You know, God had made a covenant with Israel, a covenant agreement. Okay? You obey me. You follow me. Okay? And when you do that, then this is what I do. I bless you. And I give you the blessings of the covenant. But now God's saying, you broke the covenant. You didn't obey my voice. So I'm removing the blessings of the covenant. Now we're not under the direct covenant here, but I think the principle's still there. You read about the blessings of God in the scriptures, what God does for Christians. Those aren't guaranteed when you disobey God and don't do what he asks at all. You still get them anyways. So I think the principle is still there. Okay, honor God and he blesses. Don't honor God and he doesn't. And so, all right, let's keep moving on. So we see this pattern of disobedience continue throughout the entire book. Now, the book of Judges covers a large time period. I saw one source say 350 years, another source say like 450 years. I didn't do research into it to try to figure out why the discrepancy, and what, I don't even know if it is a discrepancy. Maybe one's just talking about this period of the Judges and someone else expands it out and includes more. I don't know. It could be one was talking, not including the time of Eli and Samuel, and was only talking about the limited time of the book of Judges. Again, I don't know. I didn't research it. But my point is this. It's a long time period. Whether you talk about 350 years or 450 years, it's a long time period. And during this time period, it's a theocracy. So God is ruling through judges. And I'll come back to that in a moment when I give Moses as an example of at least certain aspects of what that means to be called a judge. But let's look at this cycle in the book that exists here. And we're in Judges chapter 2. We'll look at verse 11 as the first point on our slide here, sin. It says, and the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. And in this specific verse, they served Balaam. They forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and follow other gods of the gods of the people that were round about them and bowed themselves unto them. Okay, so this is the sin. Now, what about the servitude? Okay, servitude, slavery of some kind, service to another foreign king. What's that about? Well, the end of verse 12 says, and provoked the Lord to anger. So they forsook the Lord, served Baal and Ashtaroth. So verse 14, the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he delivered them into the hands of spoilers that spoiled them. Spoilers, people that came in and robbed them of things. I mean, that was a lot of the motivation of one nation conquering another. Hey, has anything changed? I remember the first Persian Gulf War. That's what Saddam Hussein wanted. Let's invade Kuwait. We see their oil supply. We want it. So they did. And then many of the nations of the world stood up and said, no, we're not letting you do that. And so the first Persian Gulf War happened. What happened with Hitler? World War II. What did he want? He wanted resources that other nations had. So he invaded places that had resources that he wanted. And I think eventually he wanted, you know, domination. He wanted to make an empire. But in the beginning, some of the places that he invaded were rich in resources that that he needed to do what he wanted to do, to build the things he wanted to build. Well, you know, things haven't changed. it was that way at this time. It's that way now. People like to enrich themselves at the expense of others. And so that's what happened with the nation of Israel. So the anger of the Lord was hot against them. He delivered them into the hands of the spoilers, those that would come in and take things from them and enslave them and oppress them. And it says he sold them in the hands of their enemies round about so that they could not any longer stand before their enemies. Well, previously we saw that in the book of Joshua, that the nation of Israel was able to conquer places because God was fighting for them. And not because they were a strong people themselves. Later in scripture, they're described by God as one of the weaker nations. So that didn't choose you because you were strong. You were one of the least of the nations. Now, at times, I'm sure they thought they were hot stuff. Hey, human weakness, right? Don't we have that temptation? We need to be careful with that. We don't start thinking when things go really well as a Christian, you start having spiritual victories that you think it was you. I mean, we saw an example of that with Moses, with striking the rock when he was supposed to speak to it. I pointed that out in Sunday school. Must we fetch you water? Okay, as if he was part of the process of fetching water. He was not fetching water. He was just obeying God, and then God caused the water to come out. And so it can happen with us. You lead a person to Christ, you didn't save them. You were just the instrument God used, like the hymn says, channels only. We're just channels. God flows through us as channels to do what he wants. But we got to be careful because in our human weakness, we sometimes forget that. We can be puffed up. We can become prideful. We can start to think that we're hot stuff if things go well. What happens if as a church we start to grow? What if our church starts busting at the seams full of people? Yeah, it could be a temptation of those who had a part in that. It's pastor or deacons or Sunday school teachers, whoever, to start feeling really good about ourselves, that what we've done has caused this. And if we don't give God the credit and the glory in it, then sometimes God takes away the blessing and those things can stop. And so here, it was God who allowed them to stand strong in the face of their enemies. But now God says, I'm not going to do that anymore, and you're not going to be able to stand strong. Okay, that's point number two, the servitude. God sends them into servitude. Okay. And so, going along with that, verse 15, whithersoever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them. So now, they don't have God fighting for them. God's punishing them. His hand is against them. And as the Lord had sworn unto them. God told them this is the way it was going to be. And we need to listen to the scriptures when the scriptures tell us things. Okay? It's not like God doesn't tell us the truth and the way things are. And what's going to happen when we obey and what's going to happen when we disobey. It's not like God keeps things a secret and then laughs at us when we fail. God gives us what we need to succeed. God's given us everything we need to succeed as Christians, but where we go wrong is when we don't listen. We don't follow. We don't read. Okay, we don't try. I'll say it now and then we will focus on it later. Judges chapter 17, verse 6, and Judges chapter 21, verse 25, pretty much say the same thing, the two verses. Okay, in those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Okay, so in those days, they didn't have a leader standing up, a king, kind of moderating things, making sure, okay, let's not get too far this way, trying to steer the people in the right direction. In the days of the judges, there was no king in Israel. Now, understand that the judges weren't kings. I'm going to compare them to Moses in a little bit. Moses was a national leader, but the judges weren't always national leaders like Moses. So in that sense, the judges were often different than Moses. But I'll just express in some ways how Moses exemplifies at least certain aspects of what they did. So there wasn't a national leader always leading them, like now, or like, during the days of Moses and like the days of the king. So, who did people look to for guidance, or how did they decide as a group which direction to go? Well, the second half of chapter 17, verse 6, chapter 21, verse 25 says, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And so there's another temptation on the part of people. We stop looking to God for guidance. We stop looking to a leader who's looking to God for guidance, okay, like a king, if it's a godly king, okay, or Moses, okay, or how about in church, maybe we don't look to the scriptures for guidance, or we don't look to our pastor who's looking to the scriptures for guidance, then what do? Well, we try to decide that on our own. Every man does that which is right in his own eyes. And that is a problem, and we'll see that be part of the problem in the book of Judges. Okay, but all right, how about point three on our slide here? Supplication. Okay? Well, supplication, it's a word in the Bible that's used for a type of prayer. Okay? In everything give thanks, Bible tells us. But we're told everything by prayer and supplication, let your requests be made known unto God. Everything by prayer and supplication. Well, I think this is a prayer where you're asking God to supply your needs. So maybe that'll help us with that, because it doesn't start off with the first part of, or most of the word supply there. If we change the I to a Y, it has supply in it. Let pray to God to supply our needs. Where do we see that? Judges 2, verse 18. When the Lord raised them up, let me skip the first part of that. The last part of the verse 18. For it repented the Lord because of their groanings by reason of them that oppressed them and vexed them. Now, it repented the Lord. Now, the idea of the word repent, I mean, yeah, it can be, I'm sorry for my sin, you repent of sins. But the idea behind it is a turning from something to something else. And so, yeah, when I was saying I sinned, and I turn from that and say I don't want to do that anymore, I'm sorry for what I did, that's repenting. Here it isn't God repenting of sin, it's God saying this, I sent you into servitude. But now I'm listening, it says there, why does he repent? By reason of their groanings. I hear your prayers. I hear you crying out to me. And now I turn from the slavery and the servitude and the oppression that you had. I turn from that to do something else for you. And so that's what it means here. It repented the Lord. Now he's not saying I made a mistake. He's not saying I did anything wrong. He's turning. Because of their groanings. Now, why were they groaning? By reason of them that oppressed them and vexed them. So here they are in the slavery and the oppression. Finally, they turn to God. They wouldn't do that when times were peaceful, times were going well. But now, God's got their attention. They cry out to God for help. Okay. And then, God helps them. And it tells us step three on supplication, kind of after it said step four. Let's back up to verse 16. Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges, which delivered them out of the hands of those that spoiled them. And then down in verse 18, the first part. And when the Lord raised them up judges, then the Lord was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge, for it repented the Lord. So then the order here is saying, I delivered them by judges for or because of this reason. And that's where he mentions that. So our last point there is salvation. God would listen to their prayer of supplication and then raise that up. Now we're using the word, some of these are kind of not common words for us to use, but the S's might help us to remember the cycle. So therefore we don't say sin, punishment, prayer, and salvation. We say all the S's there. Okay. So let me read through verse 23 just again to get a feel for this. And it came to pass when the judge was dead that they returned and corrupted themselves more than their fathers. So then the cycle starts over. We go back to verse 17. After God would give them a judge in verse 16, in verse 17, and yet they would not hearken unto their judges. Now the judges were standing there as a leader to try to keep them on the right track, but oftentimes they did not listen, just like in the days of Joshua, where Joshua says, make your choice. If you don't think it's right to serve God, well, choose who you're going to serve. But he knew there was a problem there, and so the problem continued with the judges. And it says they went a-whoring after other gods. They prostituted themselves away from God, who should have been their spouse. Much like the church is the bride of Christ, and we should not abandon our spouse and committing spiritual adultery and spiritual prostitution. But that's what they did. They turned quickly out of the way of their fathers, that their fathers had walked in, obeying and who obeyed the commandments of the Lord. But they did not so. And so then, when the judge was dead in verse 19, when he stopped having that moderating influence over them, wow, floodgates open. They could really do what they were already doing, but was kind of kept tampered down or under control, and corrupted themselves more than their fathers did. So things got worse and worse. Okay, now we're not going to do a lot with the last half of the book of Judges, although I don't know, by next time I speak, maybe I'll be tempted and get into it more, but when you see some of the things that were true of Israel, after we get done with the first 12 judges, or the 12 judges that are mentioned in the book of Judges, going all the way through Samson, I knew I was saying the wrong S word. When you get done with Samson, it goes into this, what one commentator calls the epilogue of the book. And the things that Israel's doing are just crazy. You think, man, that's pretty bad, the behavior. And I think, you know, corrupted themselves more than their fathers. Sometimes things got worse. You're thinking, what in the world is going on? This is the nation of Israel. This is God's chosen people. What in the world are they doing? Okay. Well, the anger of the Lord would go hot against them again. The cycle would continue. And he causes the nations around to have problems. And verse 23, therefore the Lord left those nations without driving them out hastily, neither delivered he them into the hands of Joshua. And so, because of the people's sin, otherwise he would have made this a place for God's people where they would have thrived spiritually, but their own sin caused it not to be that way. All right, let's go to our next slide. Now, I don't know how readable this is for us here in the auditorium, but let's call it readable enough. Most of the information on here, it's not that big a deal if we can see all of it. It gives like a quick summary of the judges, but we're going to start with Othniel, so we can count here 14 judges. Where do we get that from? Othniel, that's 1, Ehud, 2, Shamgar, 3, Deborah, 4. Now, Barak served alongside with her. Deborah's clearly identified as the judge, but she asked Barak to execute certain things, and we'll take a look at that. So that was number 5, Gideon, 6, Tola, 7, Jair, 8, Jephthah, 9, Ibzan, 10, Elon, 11, Abdon, 12, Samson, did I get out of order there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and I just knew Samson should be 12, and when 12 wasn't showing up on Samson, I said to myself, Houston, we've got a problem. 12 judges there, and then Eli and Samuel outside the book of Judges, and there's our 14. Okay. What about this idea of what a judge was? Well, like I said, I wanted to use Moses as an example. There's a passage in Numbers chapter 12 that expresses a little bit about Moses' ministry to the people as a judge. He had a heart for people. You see this especially in this particular one. We are told, by the way, that, and this is in Numbers chapter 12, verse 3. Now the man Moses was very meek above all the men which were upon the face of the earth. Think of meekness as strength under control. What would have happened if Hitler had been a meek man? Okay, what if he had been one who used his strength to benefit others? His strength under control, not for himself, but what if he had been like Moses, where his goal was to help the people and serve the people and lead the people so that they were doing well under his leadership? It involves meekness, but it also involves other things. Love of justice and mercy and truth and having a love. You know, the second greatest commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. So that's the leader Moses was. This guy was a strong leader, the Bible tells us, very meek. Strength under control. Now, you're not a meek person if you're just a weak person. If you have no strength to be under control, then we don't say, hey, you're really meek. No, but someone who is strong but controls it for the benefit of others. And so he really exhibited what we read about in Mark chapter 10 of a leader. Okay? Mark chapter 10, but Jesus said, let me tell you what it's not going to be like as a leader. You're not going to be like the leaders that we see around us in our society, secular leaders who lead in an authoritarian fashion. He says, you're not going to be that way in Mark 10:43, but whosoever will be great among you shall be your minister. That word diakonos. They're going to minister to the needs of others. Well, that was Moses. Whosoever of you will be chiefest shall be servant of all. Okay, so what happened with Moses in Exodus? Well, he sat to judge from the morning until the evening, serving the people. And in Judges chapter 18, his father-in-law Jethro came over to where Moses and the children of Israel were for a visit. Now, his father Jethro lived in Midian. That's where Moses had been during those 40 years when he tended sheep for his father-in-law. That's not real far away from the area of Mount Sinai, where the Ten Commandments were given and where Israel was at this time. So he came over for a visit, and his father-in-law Jethro sees Moses, and he says, "What you're doing is not a good thing." Well, why? Well, because you're working too hard. You're working from the morning till the evening, and you're trying to minister to the people all yourself. What was he doing? He was judging. Well, what's some examples of this? Okay. Well, when he was judging, in part, he was communicating God's law to the people. Here's what God says. So he's helping to teach them and communicate. When people would have problems, they'd come to him and say, "What do you think? What's your judgment? What's your decision? Okay, what kind of discernment do you have, Moses?" And he would share with them the scripture and the law and help them. Sometimes it was disputes. Two people, we've got a conflict. Sometimes the conflict would be regarding parts of the law that were more civic matters, not really religious related, not really so much moral issues. But as I think I gave an example once, my neighbor borrows my ox, and in the process of borrowing my ox, which would be like borrowing your tractor, something bad happens. What do you do? I remember once I borrowed a trailer from someone here in the church, and when I was driving it, nicked the side of it on a rock and blew the tire. So, what do you do? Well, I went down and bought a new tire. I was borrowing it. Well, it's not my trailer. Yeah, well, I damaged it. Well, the law pertained to things like that. Something happened to the man's ox while you were borrowing it. You know, so sometimes that makes us, you know, be cautious about borrowing, right? Because, you know, you're taking possession, you're taking responsibility. So Moses would deal with things like that. Sometimes it was matters of right and wrong and so forth. So Moses would sit as a judge. Now, he eventually follows his father-in-law's advice, delegates, you know, trains more judges and delegates to them responsibility and takes some of the pressure off of him because Moses is doing too much, and so he listens to his father-in-law. But that's an example. Well, who are these judges? They were leaders, but they were leaders like Moses, sometimes rise up and not just be leadership, but they would be judging matters and executing judgment, teaching the law of God, leading the people, and sometimes actually, like we think of judges, settling disputes in court, things like that. They would do those things. Okay, so during this time period, when we see on our chart here, Othniel is the first of the judges, and we read about him in Judges chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. We're not going to read all these sections here, but I'll mention a few things about some different judges. One commentator likes to break up the time of the judges into different periods and describes this as Othniel versus Mesopotamians. Okay. Well, we read some here of Othniel. He is the nephew and son-in-law of Caleb. And Caleb had been one who we know is a fighter. And he had conquered some of the inhabitants and was a strong man. And so we read, though, back in Joshua chapter 15, Caleb said, "He that smiteth Kiriath Sefer and taketh it, to him I will give Aksa, my daughter, to wife." Okay? I always kind of wondered what Aksa thought of that. I don't know. Is this a great thing? Yay, I'm going to get... I get the champion. Or is she like quivering in her bedroom like, "Oh, I hope he's nice"? Okay. I don't know. cultural thing where they would do arranged marriages. But anyways, Caleb says, hey, I've got a daughter, Aksah, and whoever conquers this area is going to get her to wife. And verse 17 says, and Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, took it. So Othniel had a brother whose name is Kenaz, and his son, so this would be Othniel, or this would be Caleb's nephew. And Caleb's nephew took it. And so then Caleb's nephew, so I guess he'd be marrying your cousin. Now, is that right or wrong? And, you know, I talked about that in one message before. Not in and of itself, but for most Americans, that's a little weird. I'm not going to take time to even talk about that one. But that's what happens. And so now we have Othniel is a person who you'd say maybe is a mighty man of valor, a strong person, a strong leader. Okay. And God raises him up as a judge in Judges chapter 3, verses 7 through 11. Okay. And so then we get to our second judge, Ehud. Ehud was a left-handed Benjaminite. So now, if my wife is any indication of lefties in general, then lefties think about being left-handed a lot more than righties think about being right-handed. Because I think she likes being left-handed, and she wanted our kids to be left-handed. It was if my kids should ever see this, sorry guys, you were a disappointment to your mom because none of you turned out to be left-handed. But she really wanted them, one of them. I think she'd have been happy if all of them were left-handed. If my wife's any indication, left-handed people think about being left-handed and it means something to them. I think they feel picked on and stuff like that. So I've seen a store once where it was all about left-handedness. You could go in the store and everything was made for left-handed people. And they would have mugs that, you know, talked about being left-handed, and they would have tools and things that were made for left-handed people, you know, like scissors, for example, where it's like curved for your right hand, so it feels just right. And a left-handed person's like, this is not right. It's not working for me. So anyways, I think they feel picked on and left out. Well, Ehud was a left-handed man. So you lefties of the world, you could bond with Ehud and feel like he's your hero here. And he's going to be in a time period, again, here when we're dealing with the Mesopotamians and people east of Israel. The second period. I should take that back. Ehud is going to be fighting the Moabites, and during the second period, we'll talk about Shamgar in a moment with the Philistines. We'll see in Ehud, I'm going to read a little bit more about him. You'll see that cycle of disobedience. In fact, let me go back to our previous slide and see that cycle of disobedience there. Think about that while I'm reading. Judges chapter 3, verse 12. And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel. So the children of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. And when the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, the Lord raised them up a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, a man left-handed. And by him the children of Israel sent a present. Well, let me pause there before we talk about that present. Hopefully you saw and heard in that the cycle of disobedience that happened. And so now God raises up Ehud. And so by him, the children of Israel sent a present unto Eglon, the king of Moab. That's verse 15. Now, if you know the story, you might be thinking, yeah, I remember what the present was. Well, no, that's not what it's talking about. They did send a present. Just Ehud has a bonus present. Okay. Well, we'll get to the bonus present in a moment. There was some sort of a present that was there. Now, this is not a nice little package wrapped up in a bow and stuff. I'll tell you why I think that. I'll get to that in a moment. But let's look a little bit about the description of the bonus present. Verse 16, but Ehud made him a dagger which had two edges of a cubit length, and he did gird it under his raiment upon his right thigh. So somewhere over here on this side, he has it hidden. So this is a conceal and carry weapon here, and he puts it there and hides it under his whatever he's wearing. And so it's a cubit length. Well, a cubit's approximately from elbow to end of hand. So that's quite a long dagger that's there. This would be a shorter cubit. A longer cubit could be up to an additional 6 inches. So 18 to 24 inch dagger that he's making there, approximately. And so he brought the present unto Eglon. Now not the dagger, the other present. And it says that it's interesting, verse 17, and Eglon was a fat man. Well, it actually doesn't say that. It adds a word. Eglon was a very fat man. Now, I don't know how fat very fat is, but this guy was very fat. Okay. And when he had made an end to offer the present, this is Ehud, he sent away the people that bear the present. Well, that's how we know it wasn't just a little box or something. He had a group of people that he needed to carry it. So this was quite, I don't know if it was a single item that was really heavy or if it was lots of items, many trunks, many boxes or jars or whatever they were carrying the present in. Doesn't ever say what the present is, but he had an entourage of helpers that were bringing to this king that they are in servitude to. And perhaps it's one of those tributes that they were required to. You know, this, they're being spoiled. They have to pay tribute on a regular basis. Maybe it's that. So they bring it in, this present, to Moab. Well, Ehud sends them all away that had helped him and says, verse 19, he himself turned again from the quarries that were by Gilgal and said, I have a secret errand unto thee, O king, who said, keep silence. Okay, so I got a state secret. I got to tell you. Okay? And says, Ehud came, back up a little bit, end of verse 19, and all that stood by him went out from the king. So the king says, don't say, send everyone out of the courtroom. He's actually in a summer parlor, a summer palace area. Okay. And that wasn't uncommon, by the way. So sometimes when you get, you know, people will have a summer and a winter home, if they're wealthy and be able to, take advantage of, you know, nice seasonal climates that are nicer in this area at this time of the year and nicer in that area at the other times and so forth. Well, anyways, Ehud said, I have a message from God unto thee. And he arose out of his seat and Ehud put forth his left hand. Stick that in, left-handed, strategically, it's easier to reach across here. Pull out that dagger, and it says that the haft, which would be like you got the handle, and then you've got that little, the haft, the little side things that stick out, that separate, so your hand doesn't actually slip past that down the blade. Like you go to stab something, you don't want your hand to keep on going. If all of a sudden it sticks, stops, you got the haft that stops you from doing that. Well, he stuck it in Eglon's belly, and it sunk into all that blubber, and the haft went in too, and he couldn't get it back out again. Now, he doesn't have time to surgery and all that. He's got to get out of here. He just killed the king. It says that the haft went also after the blade, and the fat closed upon the blade so that he could not draw the dagger out of his belly, and the dirt came out. I think that'd be like the intestinal contents. Started coming out, and it's like, so then Ehud went forth through the porch, shut the doors of the parlor, and locked them. So he secretly left, locked the doors behind him. Long story short, the servants came, they finally get the doors open, and they find their king dead, and then Ehud rallies Israel around him to fight against them. They win the battle, and so verse 30, so Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest 80 years, 80 years of not being under oppression. Okay. Now Shamgar, I'll mention really quick. There's not a lot to mention about him. In Judges chapter 5, verse 6. You know what? I don't know if I have the reference on this one because I don't put a lot in my notes on him. Let me see if I have it back here. And no, I think actually there's a reference to him in chapter 5, but no, at the end of chapter 3, talks about Shamgar killing 600 Philistines with an ox goad. Yeah, it'd be like a cattle prod of some kind. And so a sharp stick that he uses as a weapon against him. And so there's not a lot said about Shamgar, but he's raised up as a judge. He's identified as a contemporary of Deborah. And that tells us these people were not always national leaders. Sometimes you had a judge leading this part of Israel was under oppression with this group, but another part of Israel wasn't near them. Like Shamgar, the Philistines was what we refer to now as the Gaza Strip in Israel. There's still some cities there that are in that area that bear names similar to what you read about in Bible times. But Tel Aviv is down in that area, right on the Mediterranean coast in the southern part of Israel. Well, I doubt the Philistines were plaguing the northern part of Israel that much. The Philistines never really came in and conquered the whole of Israel, but they would come in and conquer parts of Israel. So you would get regional judges who are executing judgment in parts of Israel and leading against the problems in that part. So that's kind of how someone like Shamgar and Deborah could be contemporaries. Again, they're not national leaders. Now, Shamgar might be a lesser judge, you know, doing judgment in a smaller area. And I think someone like Deborah would be more of a major judge, maybe having influence over a larger part of Israel. So sometimes those things would happen. And so we'll pick up next time with the third period. Deborah battling people right there in the land of Canaan. And so we'll save that for next time. All right. Well, let's go ahead and close our time in prayer.